podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the first of our informal chats for you, our Patreon subscribers. We greatly value the support that you're offering Ness and Dormer. We literally couldn't do it without you. And we are trying this season to produce some content specifically for you in the format of some largely informal chats. And we'd like to continue beyond the broadcast itself to the Twitter feed or perhaps in the comments section where you can join in, because everything we do here with our informal chats will be available to yourselves. What do I mean by that? Well, where Rob Smythe and myself are about to watch the top 20 goals from Mexico 86, and we'll put the link somewhere. We haven't quite worked out where, but we'll put the link somewhere, or you could just find it by putting into YouTube World Cup Mexico 86 top 20 goals. So you'll be able to watch those goals that we're going to discuss, and you can make your own comments, and we will, of course, get back to you. So without further ado, as the cliche has it, I shall welcome Rob Smythe. Rob, hello.
Morning, Gary. How are you doing?
I'm in mid-season form. How about yourself?
Yeah, just tickety-boo.
Right, we're experimenting here, so it might not go off without a hitch. It
might be a shambles.
we'll see how it goes.
We should stress that the top 20 goals video we're watching is the BBC countdown, which we played at halftime in the final. So, we'll post a link, but also it means that the running order is quite interesting. I mean, this is what something we'll discuss. There's a particularly good goal at number 16 that makes you think if that's the 16th best, Jesus. But this is one of my favourite, all-time favourite compilations. I'm not sure any World Cup has produced quite so many iconic and or spectacular goals. But anyway, let's get into it.
Okay, so first up, it's the example, really, of its time, because it's the USSR, Rob.
Mm. Yeah, so the first one is Sergei Alenikov, I think that's it. USSR's first game, 6-0 against Hungary, and they were two up in about 5 minutes, I think. And this is the... Hungary were a half-decent team. This is the second goal. Belanov just sort of half-miscontrols the ball, then runs away from it. Alenikov comes onto it about 30 yards and just absolutely leathers it. It's an absolute pelter. They were a cracking team who scored a few. Vasily Rat scored an incredible goal against France, which will probably come up later. But yeah, just a classic long-range screamer, really.
Well, it's very much a World Cup goal, by which I mean these weren't the kind of goals that were scored that often in English football. Well, there's the likes of Ronnie Radford's goal, but they always seem to come up more frequently in World Cups. Perhaps it's because we saw World Cups more, but there were a couple, I think, of structural reasons why this would be the case. I'll go with three reasons why this may be the case. First of all, at World Cups, you had better players who were more confident and more willing to take the shots on, and where there's the opportunity to perhaps lay it off and get a cross into a big centre forward to Mark Haitley it into the top corner from 6 yards out. Perhaps the overseas players that we saw in World Cups were more willing to take the shot on. But two other reasons are definitely in play here. There's the ever popular controversy about the World Cup ball. And the World Cup ball was always said to be two things. It was always said to be lighter and more susceptible to movement in the air. And so whether this is a kind of confirmation bias or not, I don't know. But there was always sort of training camps where you'd be interviewing sort of Glenn Hoddle or somebody and saying, yeah, you know, we're... And he'd be on with Shilton or something and be saying, yeah, we are trying more shots from outside the box because, you know, this new ball that we're using. And there's a brilliant website which it just contains photographs of World Cup balls, which doesn't sound much, but...
Oh, just, it does.
It's just so evocative, isn't it, Rob? It really is. But I don't know whether this was the legendary sort of Adidas Tango ball or whatever they were using. They all had names as well, which gave them a kind of extra aura about them. But they certainly did seem to be lighter. And even in the mid-80s, the balls being used in English football were not the leather caseys of the 50s into the 60s, but were still quite heavy, I think, compared to the World Cup ball. So the ball seems to fly faster and swerve more because it's the World Cup. But secondly, this match looks like the Aztec Stadium. I'm not absolutely certain. But the World Cups often seem to be played, obviously, in summers, but also at altitude where the ball would fly quicker through the air. And this shot seems to go in at a hell of a speed. And we're going to see some shots later that also travel fast through the thinner air. So there was a sense in which at a World Cup, buying a ticket for the lottery with a 30-yard blockbuster was a better bet than it would be on, dare one say, a wet night at Stoke.
It's an interesting point. I've always thought of these types of goals as the kind that could be scored anywhere from a World Cup final to Hackney Marshes, you know, just head down. But the point you make about the balls is interesting, because now I think about it, it feels like it happens more in English football maybe in the Premier League era than it did before that. I don't know. So, yeah, you might have a point.
Well, it's partly a point I was going to make, because I don't want to pull back the curtain here and get inside baseball, but we were going to do a different set of videos, weren't we, Rob? Mm. And a different set of goals. And that was going back to 1969 even. And it's quite clear in the 70s that the ball is heavier and does not travel in the air anything like the way it does today. You can see it most obviously with goalkeepers' clearances. We talk often, ad nauseum, literally ad nauseum in cricket about the ball and what manufacturer it used and how it travels in different parts of the world and how it goes at Johannesburg compared to Cape Town. But we very seldom have that conversation about a ball in football. There's been a little more since Ronaldo and others Gareth Bale, amongst others, have used this technique where it borrows a little from baseball, where they aim to ensure by kicking the valve that the ball does not rotate in the air and therefore is more susceptible to kind of Formula One type ground force or whatever it is to pull it down and to change its aerodynamics. But given the amount of data that's out there, there's surprisingly little, I think, studies or articles that I've come across that tries to analyse how the travel of a ball in the air has changed over the years. And indeed, the kind of things that you get all kinds of analysis of in Opta and others, what the percentages are of shooting from outside the box compared to inside the box. Didn't Sam Allardyce do something and said, never shoot from outside the box because it's always better to pass into it?
That rings a vague bell, although I don't know how that tallied with JJ Okocha roofing goal spectacular from 25 yards. But yeah, there've certainly been a couple of people. Van Hal wasn't a big fan of it. I forget now, but yeah, no, I think you're right, actually. And now I'm envisaging a dark day in about 20 years' time when analysts are, you know, measuring the altitude and everything else and the pressure of the ball and giving their midfielders a percentage, basically, of how valid a long-range shot is. But yeah, it's a good point, actually. I hadn't thought about the heavier balls in English football, but it makes you wonder how people like Bobby Charnock managed to do it on an almost fortnightly basis.
Well, they stood out, didn't they? There was the Jimmy Cases and others. I mean, they tended to be the players who were on Match of the Day.
That's the other thing. We have no idea kind of what level this was going on in Division 3 and 4 in the way we do now. You know, if you watch a goals roundup from the Leagues 1 and 2, you'll see probably, I don't know, every weekend you'll see three or four absolute bluters from 30 yards. So, yeah, maybe it also ties in with that. You're right, the kind of rarity, and then suddenly you see every game. And that was the whole joy of the World Cup, I guess, before saturation.
Yeah, it was. World Cup goals are that they're an immense hodgepodge of World Cup goals. But the reason, and many listeners will remember the days before Sky, the reason why we seem to have so many great World Cup goals is, of course, there were so many great goals scored. But as you quite rightly point out, Match of the Day was covering two matches, and the big match would do some regional stuff. So there may have been each weekend of football, in league football, there may have been, I don't know, 12 matches covered, four of which would have been in the lower leagues, maybe even less than that.
Yeah, it's why you often had a goal of the month actually wasn't that good, or like a goal of the season competition, because they're selecting from a limited... some of them were obviously magnificent, but sometimes you can think, is that it? And it's probably because they were just selecting from a pretty small base. But yeah.
I was there in 81 or 82, 82 I think it was, when Tony Morley scored the goal of the season at Goodison. Yeah, 81. Yeah, I was at Goodison. I was at the other end. But there was, I mean, I've told this story before, so I won't labour it. There was a kind of hush after the ball went in, and then applause. I think it helped that Tony Morley was a Scouser. But he broke from the halfway line there and then lashed it in from 20 yards. And it was such a surprise to see him take the shot on, because everybody sort of expected him to go on and lay it off or try and go round the keeper. But he, as the word has it these days, he took it early because it was a relatively rare thing to do. And not only was it goal of the month, it was goal of the season, where now seeing a player run through and have a shot is, I wouldn't say it's every match, but it's certainly every week on Match of the Day.
No, you're right. I can't disassociate that goal with the celebration, which he does this weird thing where it looks like he humps fresh air for a split second. It's really strange, and I can't get it out of my mind's eye. But anyway, should we move on to number 19?
You'll be pleased to hear that now neither can I. So Julio Romero of Paraguay.
Yeah, it's an excellent goal. This is a late equaliser against the host, Mexico. Romero, or Romerito as he was known, he's kind of a bit of a forgotten player, certainly in this country, or maybe he was never known in the first place. But he was South American Footballer of the Year in 85, which is good going given some of the players who were around. And this is a lovely goal. I don't know who, someone puts a cross in from the right, and he, what is he, about 10 yards out? He does well just to get in front of the defender, but then having done that, he steers this, it's a really accomplished header into the far corner. I always think that headers like that are slightly underrated, because you almost have to fight just to get to the ball, and to then still have the awareness, composure and skill to guide it where you want to is really impressive. And it was an important goal because Paraguay won their first game 1-0 against Iraq. It was a tight group because you had Mexico, Paraguay and Belgium all had realistic ambitions of going through. Now, eventually they all did go through with Belgium in third place, but at this stage you don't know that. So it was a really important goal for Paraguay. And actually, funny, there was an even more dramatic end to the game because Mexico then got a dodgy penalty, and I think it was saved, or did they miss it? I forget, but anyway, a very late penalty that they didn't score. So yeah, ended 1-1. Yeah, just a kind of one of those goals. It's not spectacular, and you might look and think, yeah, but actually, when you break it down into the kind of nuts and bolts of what he has to do, it's just a really classy, impressive bit of play.
Yeah, a couple of observations from me is that what I liked about this header is that he almost heads it up because he's 10 yards out, and so he can't deflect it because it wouldn't have enough pace. He's decided to go, if you like, against the coach's manual, and instead of heading it back from whence it came and going for what would be the top right hand corner that he's looking at, he's gone for the left hand corner. So he's slightly sort of wrong footing the goalkeeper to some extent, but he definitely, as you say, he steers it, and with just enough lift on the header. It's an aimed header rather than a kind of hoped for header. And it goes in the host side netting before the back of the net, which to me is always the mark of a good goal. If you've scored the goal by hitting the side netting before it hits the back of the net, even as deep as these goals are, and in Mexico they were the kind of antithesis of, was it QPR, Loftus Road, where the net didn't have any depth at all? It was just kind of, you know, a stanchion and then of one foot. These are the opposite. These are great sort of trawlers here that dolphins would fail to get out if you were on the trying to catch tuna. So it hits the side of the net, which I always think is a mark of a goal that's been steered or shot or headed appropriately. And then just another kind of half observation here. Anybody who watched any sport in the 80s would be familiar with this. There's a banner behind the goal. Lots of advertising space not being used by FIFA. There are marketing executives now pulling their hair out. But instead, the banner says, Rob, you can give the punchline.
Oh, hang on, I've moved on to next. Have you? I knew this would be a shambles.
No, it's I've rather sold you a dummy there. Well, I'll give you it, because it was at so many sports grounds in right across all sports, and it says John 3:16, and yeah. there was a guy who, and he had members of his evangelical group or whatever, would always get into the US Open or places like this, and they would hold up this John 3:16, and as far as I know, its effect on those of us who grew up watching acreages of sport in the 1980s is such that we have never read John 3:16. We don't know what it means now, but it seems to have gone. It went probably about 20 years ago now. Maybe it was a 20th century thing, but it's a real kind of nostalgia buzz. And you get this when you look at these compilations. It's not always in the foreground that you feel a nostalgia. Often it's in the background.
Yeah, I know Scott Murray always loves, he's got a great eye for advertising hoardings and things like that in these old games. Good spot.
Yeah. Okay, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, so this is from number 18, is from the quarterfinal between Spain and Belgium. Juan Antonio Senor scored a late equaliser in normal time. Belgium went on to win on penalties. It's an interesting goal. I mean, I'm not sure. I think Jean-Marie Favre's at fault, but so they have a free kick, pretty much effectively a corner almost on the right. Everyone piles in the area, and then the guy drags it back to the edge of the D, but actually beyond there, where Senor has plenty of space, just hits it first time, and it whistles in. It goes through a lot of people. It goes pretty central, and I suppose you could say Favre was unsighted, but actually, he moves too far across his goal, so he wrong-foots himself. I mean, it's still a really good strike, especially as the ball's coming across his body. And, you know, he scored one more late equaliser in a World Cup quarterfinal than I have, so I don't want to be too critical of it. But, yeah, I do think Pfaff probably should have done better. What do you reckon?
Yeah, he looks like he's been wrong-footed. Maybe there was a deflection there.
No, I don't think there was. Yeah. I mean, there might have been, but I don't think so. I think it was just he got a bit too cute. The weird thing is, I don't know why Pfaff goes to his right, the left side of the goal, and I don't know why you would do that, because if you look at the angle of the ball coming back to Senor, you would think if he's going to drive it to either corner, it's going to be Pfaff's left, because it's not like players in those days were less inclined to cut across the ball like they might now and swish it to the far side. It's more likely to go near side, yet Pfaff dances across to the other side, which I don't really understand.
Yeah, he's way over to his own right there with a ball that essentially goes pretty much into the middle of the...
You sometimes get great keepers who do... Schmeichel did it a few times. He tried to get a bit too cute at free kicks. Yeah. I would end up... it's funny, I knew this would come back to Man United at some stage, but twice in the treble season, they conceded goals at the Nou Camp, once against Barcelona, once in the final against Bayern, from free kicks. And both times, Clive Tilsley said they were deflected at commentating on ITV, and both times they weren't. It's just because the way Schmeichel had wrong-footed himself made you naturally think they'd been deflected. I wonder if it's something that happens more to great goalkeepers, and Pfaff was a great goalkeeper, maybe because it not gets too easy, but you know, they a more kind of average goalkeeper wouldn't take such a risk or wouldn't get that far ahead of themselves. I don't know. That's a bit.
Yeah. Well, I suspect that the great goalkeepers, because they can do the technical side of the game so well, start to work on things like anticipation to give themselves even more of a chance of saving. And when you work on anticipation, then the world being a contingent entity, it doesn't always come off. And maybe, you know, a lesser goalkeeper wouldn't have been indulging in anticipation. But you're absolutely right. If you anticipate anyway, you're going to anticipate the ball going in the other corner. Mm. But a couple of things that I've noticed here is that, first of all, it's that fairly rare commodity, which is a training ground goal.
Yeah, good point, actually.
There's definitely a sense that either from a corner, or perhaps what they've said is we need it not quite to be a corner, because a corner has to travel that extra distance so the defenders can get out further. But if we get a free kick between the touchline and the penalty area, we want to try this. And so it's been hit in and hitting quite hard to Senor over a bobbling ground. And this is where I think...
Yeah, that's a good point.
His technique is so good, because I've just freeze framed it here, and he has his right foot exactly where he wants it to be, and his left foot retracted almost like a kind of Sabutio player. So he's taken a bobbling ball, and there's always an element of luck in it, but you know, the more you practice, the more luck you get. Head over the ball, and therefore, instead of it sort of blasting miles over the bar the way these often do, or sort of skewing out for a throw in on the other side, he's met it absolutely perfectly, and he's made the goalkeeper make a decision about saving it. He's posed a problem to the goalkeeper, and I think you're right. Maybe sort of 8-9 times out of 10, this would be saved by a keeper, but for some reason, Pfaff is across the other side of his goal, and hats off to Senor here. He puts it away.
The point about the pitch is a really good one. I was kind of seeing it through modern eyes, just thinking of a nice flat bowling green, which would have made that shot still difficult, but a lot easier. But actually to control it that well with it bobbling that much, actually, you're right. It's really, the technique is terrific.
Well, it helps him a little bit in that, you know, there's this expression, it's set up nicely for him. And it is, I don't know why it should be the case, but it does seem always easier, and it's the same in the playground at all levels of football. If the ball is even an inch off the deck, it seems easier to hit than if it's actually
on
the deck.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know why that should be the case, because surely you're still kicking the kind of centre of gravity of the ball if you want to keep it down, or you're hitting under it if you want to go up, or you're hitting over it if you want to get some sort of top spin or something. That's more rarely.
I suppose it depends on the type of shot, doesn't it? So the classic example of it flipping up perfectly is Ronnie Radford, so you can get under it. But then other times, that's actually harder in a way, because if it's coming across your body rather than you're running onto it, in a way, it might be harder to control if it flips up slightly. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched a lot of football with my son Jesper, and I've made this point a few times, and it's quite nice to have conversations as you're watching a game, because often at the match you're just too tense to have conversations. So I very seldom talk much when I'm at the match, other than to sort of exclaim, as we all do, with errors for the refereeing or something. But when we're watching live games together, I'll often say things like, you know, it's a real low percentage there. You know, he's taken a ball at 90 degrees or coming across him. Now, you very seldom see a clean strike like that. And it's amazing how often that Jesper might then say, oh, well, it was that guy last week who did it or something. But it's amazing for something that happens quite often in a football match, which is a ball coming at roughly 90 degrees to, you know, in other words, coming across the pitch towards you.
Yeah.
And you've got to hit that moving ball. The percentages must, or the margin for error must be very tight, because you far more often see strikes that are not clean than you see clean strikes. And it's one of those things that, again, I wonder about. There's a whole load of them, free kicks, corners and stuff like this, whether if players really practiced at them, really got used to hitting that ball that's coming across you, whether they'd be better at it, because they're so brilliant at other things, obviously top flight footballers that are species apart. And yet you see so many scuffed shots blasted over the bar, miss hits, but this is the opposite. This is an absolutely clean as a whistle strike of a ball that was coming at some pace over bubbling ground that earned a draw against the hosts.
It wasn't against the hosts.
Yeah.
It was against Belgium.
Oh, was it against Belgium? Yeah.
It's
okay.
You're meshing it with the last one, but don't worry.
Oh yeah, I am. Plenty of Spanish banners there behind the goal, including a John 3:16, almost obscured. And we should point out, because we're going to see some very variable crowds at Mexico 86. This was before the kind of relatively cheap, accessible intercontinental travel where travelling support, it was there, but it wasn't there in anything like the numbers that we would get today. And I think that had a had an effect on World Cup matches. They often seemed to be sort of fairly quiet, but it also gave them an air of kind of, you know, masterclasses that we were watching in sort of silent reverence at times. Whereas, you know, every World Cup match now, no matter where it is, has got significant numbers of both teams being supported. Even Euro 96, there's matches where there's great sways of seats empty.
Massively, yeah. That's the bit they never talk about when the story is told of the great summer, English football summer of love. No one ever talks about all the games in the north that had about 10,000 people, which is so strange. But anyway,
it's a real 21st century, I think, dividing line, because I remember when first we started going to Sweden fairly regularly, and it used to cost us like 270 quid to get a return flight to Gothenburg or whatever it was. And like a year later, when low-cost flights came in, it was like £4.99. I think I once paid 99 pence for a flight. Absolutely, seriously, I paid 99 pence for a flight. If you could book ahead, and you could book, you weren't, you know, you put any 3 days either side. Quite often it was below a tenner. I remember thinking, "Oh, better leave this. They want £19.99 to go to Gothenburg here. £9.99." And there were no taxes then either. The government got wise to taxes in about 2007, 2008, I think it was. But there was a kind of golden period, and to some extent, it's still here now, where flights are accessible, and you get the Barmy Army travelling with the England cricket team, but you also get the kind of massed ranks of fans going to matches. Now, Scottish listeners will say, "Oh, there was the Tartan Army in Argentina," and there was a Tartan Army in Argentina. But even if a World Cup was played now and Scotland went to Argentina, that Tartan Army would be five times its size. Eight times its size. There'd be people who would go to Argentina just to go in the fan parks. Now, fan parks, of course, were not a thing back then. So it's another way in which you can pick up on kind of the externals, if you like, the detail around tournaments and goals and fans. And part of what we try and do here at Ness and Dormer, I think, is to bring these things to light, because it's a kind of endless joy of cricket and football. If you've spent your life watching both of those, because there's more footage of them, I'm sure it's the same for rugby supporters or cycling fans or something like that. When you dip back into the archive, you see all this stuff that you didn't necessarily see at the time. Shall we move forward to the next?
We should. Number 17, Edinho, Brazil's centre-half, in their 4-0 win over Poland in the second round. This is the third goal. We probably spoke about this before. It's a slightly flattering result, actually. Poland hit the woodwork twice. I think both times at 0-0, I think. But anyway, it became, in the second half, it became a kind of joyous romp for Brazil, summed up by this goal, really. So Edinho starts it with a big, I was going to say a hoof out of defence, but actually I think it's better than that. It's a big kind of half hoof, half pass to Careca, who makes good ground, waits and waits and waits, and then reverses a pass to Edinho, who's run about 80 yards. He just dances around the keeper and scores. It's such a classy, smooth goal. You think that's a centre-back. Edinho and Julio Cesar were the centre-back pairing, and I know Chris Freddy, who knows more about the World Cup probably than anyone alive, he thinks they were the best centre-back pairing in the world at the time. And I think Brazil only conceded one goal in the tournament in five games. But they could play as well, obviously. Brazil's centre-half generally can. It's a kind of goal that a Brazilian team scores. You can't really think of too many other teams, certainly not at that time, scoring a goal where the central defender wins the ball in his edge of his own area, runs 80 yards to accept a return pass, and then dummies the keeper. Any observations, Gary?
Well, one of them is that clearly Poland are chasing the game here,
yeah.
And what they're applying is what we would now call high press, because the players are almost all seeking to win the ball in the kind of Brazil's final third, and they've left kind of two men back, one on the halfway line and one sort of at the edge of the centre circle. But the ball has gone wide, and the central defender is never getting back here to Kareke, you say it is there? Who's...
Think so.
Yeah. But yeah. It's...
So it was just going to give context. So basically it was 2-0 with about 11 minutes to go. Yeah. So yeah, they were exactly that.
But it's an example of one of the things which I'm sure is a kind of fad, almost become a fetish now. And it's interesting to go back, you know, 34 years and show that if you give good forwards an entire half to play in, they're gonna kill you. And that high press has its disciples, and it clearly has its utility. But I do think it's coming to the end of it's coming to the end of a period in which it gains more than it loses, because it's just too easy. Clearly, coaches have decided they're going to use that space in behind the high press, and they're selecting forwards, and indeed forwards are training for it. And I just wonder whether we'll see over the next few months, if sides continue to play the high press, whether sides do what they've done here, which is to say whoever is furthest forward or whoever has the energy, just get up there and support the man who has broken the high press. And, you know, often it's Jamie Vardy and it's, you know, Harvey Barnes running onto it, but it could just as easily be James Justin or is it James Justin or Justin James?
James Justin.
Yeah, running onto it. And in Liverpool's time, of course, it's sometimes been one or both fullbacks who are coming onto it. But it doesn't really matter who goes up to support the striker. They just have to have the energy to get up there, and then the coolness to finish. And it's a sensational finish from a centre half. You're absolutely right.
It's an interesting point about the high press. I'm not sure I completely agree. I think you'll be banned from many tactical seminars from now on for criticising the high press. I mean, I do know what you mean, but it's a gamble. But there are times when it can still be so effective. I mean, I did Liverpool-Leicester last weekend, and I really thought Leicester would give them problems playing through the press, as they did so well at City and at Leeds. But Liverpool just smothered them.
I
know what you mean, though. I can't wait to see Spurs play Liverpool. That's going to be absolutely fascinating.
I think Son and Kane. I mean, a number of times, again, I don't want to go on with this, but this is kind of lockdown talk, isn't it? We're all sitting watching the telly. The number of times I've said to Jesper, they're going to get killed here because Son's going to break the press any time now, and then he does so. I actually felt that Liverpool played kind of half a high press against Leicester, because they certainly funneled back whenever Vardy was on the run. And so they didn't give him half the field to play in the way that Kareka gets half the field to play in here. So it was a kind of, they pressed with kind of five or six rather than the whole of the defence, because the defence dropped back. And of course it helps if you've got players who are quick in defence. I mean, I'm not against the high press full stop, because obviously people have worked on it, but you see far more goals of that type in the first half than you ever used to do. That was, if you'd shown me that goal there of Edinho, and you'd said what time of the match that was in 86, I would almost always have said last 15 minutes.
Yeah,
it's the last 15 minutes ago. Where now, it could be in the first 15 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point.
And I don't know. So I clearly, there's analysts, and you know, they're showing that the net gain of this is better. But I wonder if the emperor has no clothes, and somebody is going to say, and I think Liverpool did it against Vardy, we're not going to give him half the field to play in. We're going to make sure that even on the run, he's going to have a defender to deal with. Because if a player runs through and then just smashes it from 20 yards, you can't do anything about it. But if you give a player time to run through check back and make a pass in the way that Son and Harry Kane and others have done against the high press, then you're going to get killed over and over again. And Liverpool never gave Vardy that chance to check inside with any great comfort. But we're moving forward, and we should go to, I think, one of everyone's favourite World Cup players ever. He was the man who was unemployed, I think, wasn't he, at the time?
Yeah, he'd been let go by Botafogo. The unemployed hero, I think, was the headline in one of the papers. Everyone's friend Josimar from the Brazil side.
Well, Rob, just try to describe this goal, because... Well,
it's worth giving it a bit of context, just in case. I'm sure everyone knows, but just in case. So he made his debut in the previous game because of an injury to the second choice right back, as it happened, because Leandro pulled out of the squad. So Josimar was third choice. Scored an absolute screamer against Northern Ireland from 30 yards, which I'm sure everyone can picture. Then in this game, I mean, geez, I think this is an even better goal. The Northern Ireland one is probably more famous, but this comes at 1-0 early in the second half. He gets the ball on the right, sort of zigzags past a couple of players into the area, then shows really good strength to hold the guy off from behind. And just from a ludicrous angle, just blisters it into the far corner. I mean, it's just ridiculous, basically. And you can't stress enough, this is a right back. So basically, yeah, skill to beat two players, strength to hold the man off, and then an absolutely vicious hit from a really, like, if you pause it, it's almost exactly where Van Basten scores his volley. Van Basten's being tougher because it was a volley, but it's a similarly prohibitive angle. And there's a guy about to challenge him. I mean, I've got it poor. He can't score from there. It's not possible.
No, he can't score from there.
And he gets this incredible trajectory as well. So it goes to, like, get it over the keeper, but not with such an angle that it goes over the bar. It's just incredible.
You look at it and you think, well, that's a goalkeeping error. You know, he's got his angles wrong, or he's in, but it's not. It's just that nobody expects Josimar to shoot from there. I'd be amazed if two, let's face it, unmarked centre forwards on the edge of the 6-yard box, either of whom would have scored the easiest of headers if he'd pulled it back, whether they're expecting it. But it's one of those things where it's clearly flashed past the keeper before he's had any chance to react at all, because the time where he would be reacting, he's thinking, oh God, what's happened?
You know, exactly. Combination of surprise and the speed. It's just, and actually the ball is on the way down by the time it hits the net. And I don't know how you get it, hit a ball with that. I mean, we see it's sort of like the technique we see now on free kicks with where they kick the valve. Clearly here, he's just hoofing any part of the ball. But yeah, incredible.
Well, he may just have imparted a bit of top spin on it, because like you, I've frozen the frame, albeit slightly further on. And after he's taken the shot, both feet are in the air, and he's actually quite high up in the air. It's like he's rising for a header. Now, this can be the something we'll talk about in a moment, the sheer joy of what it is to be Josimar at a World Cup. But I think maybe he's hit over the ball to some extent and given it a bit of top spin, because you don't often, I think, see a player quite so high in the air having taken a shot. You know, he's not jumping up to volley this. The ball's on the ground, and yet somehow as he's kicked it, he's gone up in the air. And you're absolutely right, Rob. This should be going miles over the bar if it's got over the keeper, and yet it goes in quite comfortably.
Yeah.
Extraordinary goal.
It's another goal that is just reeks of Brazil, basically.
As does the celebration.
Yeah.
And it's a whole combination of factors in the celebration. For those of us who saw, and I can just about remember, but we've all seen it so many times before, the kind of classic Jairzinho celebrations where he would go careering down the touchline, jumping and leaping, punching the air. It's in the same kit, the iconic gold and blue.
I love this kit, by the way.
It's fantastic.
They were briefly sponsored. The maker was a brand called Topper, which I don't know much about, but the kit just looks so good. I think they did it in 86 and 90. The 90 one, I think I prefer even more because it's slightly more polyester, so it's that sheen, but yeah, it's just a glorious, glorious kit.
And there's an element of camp in the way he runs, knees kicking high in the air, both arms in the air. But you don't really see that. You see the number 13, ironically, for one of probably the luckiest players ever to be scooped out of obscurity and unemployment to become a World Cup hero. And obviously, as our discussion proves, immortal for his exploits. But it's just kind of fantastic. He's doing a kind of flash dance, was it, where Maniac song. Groundskeeper Willie doing Maniac, if you remember, in The Simpsons. But it was the Maniac Yosimar giving it the full flash dance there. And that, in some ways, that's everything you want from a World Cup goal. And we'll never have it again. We'll never have a player that we've never heard of do something as ridiculous as that and then celebrate in a way we've never seen before.
No, you're right. I always think Yosimar and Scalacci, certainly for my generation, capture that whole, like, the magic of the World Cup as a kind of voyage of discovery. And of course, when you see that, you assume he's doing this every week. When in fact, I think he barely scored two goals a year. And his career kind of drifted to nothing after that. He had problems off the field with various things. But yeah, but obviously, these are things you find out years, even decades later. At the time, you just imagine that this is what's going on. It was so low. Probably the thing I miss the most, actually, about the World Cup is just that discovery of players and even just everything, you know, kits, fans, everything, just things that were so unfamiliar. And obviously that's kind of gone now because of globalisation and saturation and Football Manager and so on, but...
I mean, it wasn't just that. In the previews in those days, you might in 86 have had one or two kind of segments on Sports Night that would look into, you know, England's opponents in the group stage, and there'd be some kind of grainy footage of Lato or somebody scoring for Wyciech Łódź in a Polish league match in 1974. But even in the newspapers, there was very, very little. There were not, I don't think, World Cup pullouts. And if they were, they were World Cup pullouts where you were, you know, had a wall chart to fill in. There was no research because it was often not possible to get research. Yeah. People were... Certainly journalists then, they were not going and buying Marca or L'Équipe and things like this. And they certainly weren't translating from local languages. I think there was France Football and there was the great guru of world football, Brian Glanville, would produce a kind of 4,000 word essay on coaching trends in Yugoslavia or something. But there was so little for even the dedicated football fan, never mind the casual football fan. So you had these list of exotic names. And if you were lucky, you got them in a Panini sticker collection. So, well, you'd actually seen them.
Yosimar wasn't, of course, in the Panini album. Which is a great story given his impact. But no, I completely agree. I mean, this is the first World Cup I remember watching properly. I sort of remember 82, but I was only six. And yeah, probably the one I remember consuming properly for the first time, as in newspapers and everything else, would be 1990. And I agree with you. By then you were getting the odd little thing, you know, I remember Match magazine, but they were really cursory previews. Partly because, like you say, I mean, how's anyone going to know about Yosimar? A lot of people in Brazil barely knew about him. Wasn't really possible. And it just made it more fun in many ways. I don't know, it's not, you know, you can't change technology and the way things develop. I'm not saying people should go back to that now, of course. You have to have more thorough previews and everything. But yeah, there's a bit of innocence that is lost with that.
I mean, you're absolutely right to indicate that we can't turn back the clock. But there would be, if one were to take a kind of really... harsh kind of vow of silence, or whatever the expression would be, and not read any previews, not watch any analysis of opponents in a World Cup in 2022 or whatever, the joy that you would have from discovering these players, going back to that age where information didn't answer the questions before they'd even formed in your mind, because that was the joy, is you would come to a Yosemite and think, well, who is this? What's he doing? How has he done that?
And how do you even say his name? There was always that as well, wasn't there? It'd be about four different pronunciations of most names.
Yeah, and you get players who came with huge reputations. You know, Zubizarreta is the world's best goalkeeper and has been for 10 years. And he's a nervous wreck, and you're thinking, well, where did that come from? And as you say, it'll never go back, but too much information in sport, too much data, I think it's one of the things that separates, and you're perhaps, Rob, the last of the generation that can find a kind of romanticism in that lack of information. But now, you know, I watched the whole of the Formula One Grand Prix the other day, because, you know, Lewis Hamilton was brilliant in winning in the wet in Turkey, I think it was. But the sheer volume of information that was coming through, you know, a tenth of a second quicker through that curve, and tyre strategies, and he's got to be 21 seconds ahead in order to ensure that the pit stop, he comes out in front and everything. And it's a bit like exposition in the theatre. I don't want to be told. I want to find out.
Mm. No, it's a good point. And actually, I think it's made writing harder as well. Certainly if you're slightly anal or maybe even OCD, there's too much information now.
Yeah.
So for example, this is going on a tangent, but last week I was writing a profile for next year's Wisden Almanac. I can't say who it's on because it's one of the cricketers of the year, but the sheer infinity of information, you know, I can analyse everything down to their ability to play the cover dry, and it makes it so hard to filter all that down. Well, it does for me anyway. Maybe it's my brain's addled, but yeah. So, and you're right, as a viewing experience as well, I always have this nagging feeling that I'm not as knowledgeable as I should be, but then I realise that whether that's as a kind of just as a fan or as a writer, but then I realized actually it's just not possible. You can't consume everything and know everything, because, you know,
what do you do,
got a family,
what do you do about that, Rob? Because I'll explain why I'm asking the question in a moment, but
I write less and do more live blogs where I find it a struggle. I do actually, and research, even for historical articles now, which I love writing generally, but I find the research a struggle because it's infinite, you know. So for example, even if say you're going to do something on Maradona just at USA 94, where do you stop? There's so much available now, whether it's newspaper archives, YouTube videos, YouTube interviews, internet articles, internet, you know, interviews with magazines, non-English language pieces you could whip through Google Translate to see if there's a nugget in there that you've missed. And it becomes a real... I mean, you just have to try to be ruthless. But actually, I'm not very good at it. I think there's a part of my brain that is... I don't know if it's OCD or what, but it's it just nags at me. Yeah, but have you checked the Daily Mirror for the Wednesday before that game? And yeah, it's a bit irritating, to be honest. I quite like, even as recently as 10 years ago, I feel... certainly 15 years ago, I feel like I would just have, you know, whatever books I had available to me, I would use those. I might read a Guardian match report or whatever, and do it more from memory. Whereas now I just feel like, yeah, you're kind of compelled to do research to a certain level. And then once you do that, you think, well, kind of in for a penny, in for a pound, I don't know.
Well, I remember when, I think it was when emails came in to my job when I was working at the university. And I remember in the space of a year, and how I characterized it was that the stress that was caused by emails was the stress that you get from turning up in the morning and thinking, what am I going to do today? As opposed to, what am I not going to do today? And there's a huge difference in the stress levels from that, because you could have a large to-do list, or you could have that you're going to, you know, struggle to get through your work. But every single day, and it started about 97, 98, I think it would be, maybe a little bit before that, there was such a difference when you just knew that the day was never going to have the capacity to get all the work done. And so what you had to do essentially was knock off the work that you were not going to do. So you knew you were going to disappoint people. You knew you were going to disappoint yourself. You knew you were going to make shortcuts. You knew you were going to fail to see stuff. You knew you were going to have a problem next week because you hadn't written that paper for the meeting that you were due to present, and so on. And I remember writing a piece about this somewhere else. It may have been on my own blog, or may have been a paper for a discussion group.
Plug your blog. Come on.
Oh no, this was
the old one.
This is a very old one, yeah. And it was about how more information does not lead to better decision making. Because what more information leads to is more information.
Yeah, and I think you're right.
You got better decision-making where you said, well, let's not consult on that before the meeting in a fortnight's time. Let's go out and do it. And sometimes you got that wrong. But it's very, very hard in any organization, or even in something like your own work there, and this is why I'm drawing the parallel, Rob, with writing, to say, actually, I've got enough information here. I've done enough consulting. I'm now going to make a decision. And there's a kind of paralysis that seizes you no matter what line of work you're in. It just gets very difficult.
Yeah, it does my head in, actually. I've been trying to work out ways to fight and get around it. Anyway, we've gone woefully off piece.
This is part of what we want to do, I think.
It's true, isn't it?
Can I just, because we do need to wrap up soon, but I just want to bring it back to sport and tell you of a decision that I've kind of made, which I feel guilty about. But it's the only way I think I can survive with what I want to do. Years and years ago, I made a similar decision about video games. And although I've played a little bit of Civilization, in the main, I don't play Football Manager. I don't play Doom or Assassin's Creed or any of these things, because I'm not going to have enough space in my head and enough time in my life to do those things. So I'm ignoring them. Now, this is going to sound controversial, but every time I turn on BBC Five Live radio, I'm getting plugs for women's football or women's cricket. Now, I've watched women's cricket live and I enjoy the match. I've watched it on television. I've commentated a guerrilla cricket on women's cricket. I've absolutely nothing against it. Likewise, I've watched women's football in Sweden, where there was a lot of it covered, especially about 10 years ago when there was no coverage on television. But I don't have enough time in my life to have women's football and women's cricket in it to the extent that the BBC in particular are pushing it, and to some extent The Guardian, where they're doing live blogs of these matches. I completely understand why it's there. I understand why there's a reason to extend the game. But I know that I can't do it. I'll watch the Women's World Cup final in both sports. But if you're asking me to follow it, to listen to the podcasts, to listen to the commentaries, to follow the personalities, the injury scares for England on their tour of West Indies and so on. I can't do it. I can't do it when I've got all the other stuff. There's too much information. There's too much data. And the way I'm managing it is perhaps closing down what would be an interesting area for my life. But because there's so much more of it now than there was 20 years ago, instead of watching the odd match here and there and seeing Sarah Taylor's greatest hits on YouTube, I'm now ignoring the whole lot because I can't get sucked into it. So I'm not watching it at all. And that feels bad, but I don't think it's entirely counterintuitive.
No, I think it's probably healthy, whether what, not necessarily women's. I mean, mine's a lot more scattergun. I'll follow. I do actually really enjoy watching women's cricket in particular, but sometimes I'll miss a game, or same with miss a men's game or miss a Man United game. I think I'm just less organised mentally. I think your way is good. I think you need that, just because there is just, our brains weren't built for this level of activity and kind of information overload. So I think you have to draw a line somewhere. Say two men who've just started doing another podcast.
But speaking of drawing lines, goal 16 is the time where we can break off, because coming back to this. But
before we go, pick your favourite of the five we've seen.
Oh, Josimar.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It has to be.
And it's the joy. It's not just it's a crazy goal. It's the joy. You can almost see it when he goes past the man, drops a shoulder or something, and you can almost see him saying, I'm going to have a shot here. I'm going to have a shot.
I'm at the World Cup.
At the World Cup. Yeah. And you should... It's always a delight when, and even in the kind of data overloads that we've talked about, millionaire, billionaire footballers, corporate business, the thing that always makes my heart sink, which is where you've got Gazprom advertised on the boards at the Champions League, every now and again, and it's less and less frequent for obvious reasons, the joy of having a ball at your feet breaks through. And one of the things in the many, many tributes, many of which are excellent, Jonathan Wilson's in The Guardian, Marcelo Moura y Araujo in The Guardian, are absolutely fantastic if you haven't read them, about Maradona. Many of them have mentioned that important element of why he was, why he connected all around the world with football fans. Never once did he stop feeling and showing the joy of being a footballer, doing what we all wanted to do but could never do. Josimar captures a bit of that in this goal.
Just a quick aside on Maradona, Liam Brady did a very good piece, I think it was in the Irish Examiner, and he made a really interesting point, which funnily enough, I spoke to Paul Doyle yesterday morning, and he independently made the same point, which is the contrast between one of the many contrasts between Maradona and Ronaldo and Messi, is that you never ever saw Maradona sort of throw his hands up in the air, like, look what I have to work with. He was always dragging his teammates along with him. He was always on their side. It was never a sense of Burke. And he played in some ordinary teams, certainly compared to the ones Ronaldo and Messi have played in. But he never, ever betrayed a frustration or anything. It was always just about the team and about winning. Very noble, actually.
Yeah, one of the... I put a tweet out about this 24 hours ago or something, because I think it was missed in a lot of the profiles. It's interesting that you said that Brady and Paul Doyle have made the point, is that it's often said that captains play a kind of almost ceremonial role in football. Well, try telling that to Franz Beckenbauer, Johan Cruyff and Diego Maradona. And Maradona was the best captain I've ever seen at football. And if you were to give me the best captains in all sports, I'd have him right up there, because for those reasons, he lifted the players around him. He was everything you did not want in an opponent. And boy, did he show it. When you walk out and you've got Maradona leading you out, and when you pick up the ball and you think, who am I going to pass to? I'm going to pass it to him. It must be like walking on air.
There's a great bit, actually, at the Italian 90 semi-final against Italy in Naples, which is obviously an incredibly loaded game for all sorts of reasons, but he really walked swaggers out. It's even by his standards, it's just really fascinating. It's almost like he knew something that nobody else did, which is that Argentina were going to give their best performance of the tournament.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. And and I'm sure stuff like that has an effect on both sets of players.
Oh, it must do. I agree with you.
He was one of the great captains.
Yeah.
No question. Right.
Well done.
Yep. We'll be back sometime with the next five goals. If you have any thoughts, send them in. Gary, you know how people can do that, don't you?
Yes, you can tweet us at Nessendorma. It's either Nessendorma or Nessendorma Pod. At Nessendorma Pod. But you'll know all this because you're our Patreon supporters, our subscribers. So you're very much in the warp and weft of this this quilt that we are sewing to throw over football in the 80s and 90s. And we are, as ever, supremely grateful for your support, both, if you like, emotionally and financially. We very much welcome it.
No, we do. I hadn't really thought of it as emotional support, but we do. Thank you.
All right. We'll see you again soon.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.